Much like in golf, life can throw you a bad bounce, a bad lie, or even an out-of-bounds take just inches from being in play. When John's PGA Tour pursuit was sidelined due to unforeseen health-related circumstances, he and his wife made the decision to be present, thankful, and reflect on everything worth fighting for. Although their battle is not over, we want to use our platform to share his story of courage and perseverance in hopes of spreading awareness and reminding everyone not to take this game of life for granted.
Please help close friend of the show, John Trasmar, by visiting his GoFundMe page and supporting his pursuit for a cause. Find the link in our bio.
Welcome to the 4Jack Podcast.
Gentlemen, welcome back to season 5 of the 4Jack Podcast, powered by our friends over at Galvin Green. Galvin Green is the number one technical golf apparel brand preferred on every professional tour. They're famous for designing high-tech, elevated golf apparel for every golfer, male or female, to feel invincible under all conditions. Head over to galvingreen.com and get your apparel game dialed in for the 2023 season. A massive thank you to our community that continues to support and share in our success. Throughout season 5, you can expect more untold stories, more amazing guests, and a deeper dive into how golf truly impacts, connects, and is celebrated by many. And that statement really rings true tonight. We're going to shift gears here on the 4Jack Podcast, and we're going to do something that's a little bit more of a personal level. So before we get into it with tonight's special guest, we're going to head down to warmer climates and check in with the AGM. Mr. Derek Lane, what's happening in SoCal tonight?
Well, Parks, you kind of alluded it. We've been really lucky. Season 5's been almost unbelievable between you and I as far as the guest list and what we still have coming, right? And we haven't even announced the big boy. So eventually we'll get to all of that in the next few weeks. But it's been by far our most active season just between the two of us and what we've booked and who we still have on the books. But you and I both come from what we love to call the Great White North, mine honorary Canadian, you being Canadian. But that being said, one of the things I've learned living in Los Angeles or living in Southern California is that the longer you're away from where you grew up, the more you really respect and miss it, right? So I really love where I live in Southern California. I don't envision myself living anywhere else. It's almost getting close that I've lived in California as much as almost half my life. So while I will always be Minnesotan and we're having a great run and the Minnesota Gopher hockey team's in the Frozen Four and we're doing things like that, one of the things that I really truly value about all of what I have in my life is it started with a little place called Riverside Town and Country Club. And there's 2 9-hole golf courses where I grew up. One was about 15 minutes away, the other about 5. And with that, it was life. It's what I knew. It's where I grew up and it's how I went about my life. And as much as I love sports and as much as I loved people, it was kind of where I grew up and became what I wanted to be, which was I wanted to run a golf course. I didn't necessarily want to be a professional. As we've talked about many times, I wasn't even the best player in my family. So it's pretty hard to think you could be professional at anything when you're second place before you leave the house. But that being said, there's just certain times in life. It just was the camaraderie, the guys, right? Cards, early underage drinking, you know, hanging out with friends. And that's why I do what I do. And you know, we have passion for where we're at. And so tonight's a big part of why it'll make a little more sense as we go. But when we kind of get through this, it's one of those episodes that I think we're going to look back at and really have a lot of fun, but yet really kind of be a little bit more serious and convey some things to the rest of the world.
Yeah, I love it. Well said. Without further ado, the 4Jack Podcast is excited and at the same time very proud to celebrate this man's courageous story of drive and perseverance while taking on one of the most enduring challenges this game of life could throw at him. We all know someone that has been affected by cancer at some capacity. And for some of us, this episode will really hit close to home. I have to warn everyone, though, for the first time ever, we have 2 Minnesotans on the show at the same time. So I'm going to do my best, I promise, to help translate if they start speaking Gopher. Former standout collegiate player who's, for the time being, put his PGA Tour pursuit on hold. Please welcome to the show, Mr. John Trasmar.
Thanks for having me, guys.
It's good to have you. It's good to see your face.
Yeah, thanks for jumping on with us. I got to start. I got to pick at you a little bit here because you're a teammate of Eric Van Rooyen, and I got to know, and our listeners want to know, like, when did his amazing fashion sense sort of establish itself? Was it back in the collegiate days, or what happened with his pants? I mean, that's the hot list item for everybody.
You know, it's funny because when he first came to Minnesota, I remember him wearing some things that we kind of referred to as more European, you know, being from South Africa. We're like, okay, we're not going to probably wear that here in America, or at least not my group of friends, but he had it right away when he came over. So once he started wearing Grayson and the jogger thing came about, it was kind of a nice fit, and he ran with it, which is good for him. Cause now it's got his own little, he's got his own little name on it.
Yeah. He's got his vibe for sure. And everybody likes to poke fun at him. I don't know if I've quite adopted that style yet, but it's a good look and he wears it well. So that's great.
He does.
And Parksy, he has to admit too. And if you had EVR in the room, he'd tell you it was tough for him. He wasn't the best looking guy on the team with JT there. And you know what? He's kind of had this part of it. So he had to take a little bit of that up front and now look at it. Now he just can't get enough of himself. I mean, the beard's great. The funny thing about EVR too is everything's getting tighter. The hat's tighter. The shirt's tighter. It's a medium now. It's like he's feeling Grayson in what it is he's doing.
He sure is.
John, you're a pretty fit guy, and Derek likes to talk about the Tom Brady days back in the collegiate wonder years. What was the regime like for you guys? Is it a pretty heavy workout system for you guys? I mean, these tight shirts and tight pants, man, I don't know.
We did. We actually worked out quite a bit. Our trainer was the hockey trainer at the time, Cal Deeds. And we were in there during the season. It was probably like 3 to 4 days a week. And then in the off season, it was 5 days a week. And it was really, we were diligent. All the guys on the team liked to work out. We liked to be in there. And so I think it was good for us because we knew, you know, being in the North, we had probably more time to work on the gym aspects of things because we weren't outside practicing 365 days a year. So we looked at that off season as a good time to get stronger, to get in better shape. And I think you've seen probably starting with Tiger back 20 years ago or whatever it was, golf fitness now is such a huge part of the game. And there's no guy out there that isn't doing something. So for us, it was a really important part of what we did, and we enjoyed it. We liked the challenge. And it did allow us to wear maybe some tighter clothes than what other teams might have been wearing. But, you know, I don't know if that was for better or for worse, but we did it.
90% of the guys on tour now are just absolutely shredded. It's almost embarrassing to us people that work regular jobs and have time to go to the gym and probably eat better, but we choose not to. So,
But Parksy, you also know when you're going to a place like Minnesota and you're playing golf, and it's hard for a lot of people in the world to understand that golf can be competitive. I think Illinois did a great job. And then obviously the Gophers won their title in the 90s, showing that through inside stuff. And there's a small school called Gustavus Adolphus that has kind of really, for us, when we were growing up, was kind of the staple if you didn't make what we called the U, which is the University of Minnesota. But nobody wears tighter clothes than hockey players. I mean, nobody, right? I mean, when you get to that point, when you've got true college guys, quadzillas everywhere, like, and you know, just the fact that the way they do things, they're already slightly off kilter, right? So it's kind of a funny thing when you start looking at where you live regionally and how this all works. I mean, I remember Parks and you first got to the quarries, the caddy is at the quarry, white pants, we had some tightness, we had the little thing under the chin, we were rocking some fun headwear, we had great mirrored shades. I mean, like, you know that people skate and people that are from the North are always just slightly different. I mean, look at Johnny Wonder. I mean, just they're, everybody's got that different little je ne sais quoi, right? Where it's just You do different things. And I don't think that's any different now.
All right, John, let's shift. let's go back to the time where tight pants weren't the topic of conversation. Let's take it all the way back. Let's talk about your introduction to the game, something that you fell in love with and has kind of pushed you forward in life.
Well, like Derek was saying, I grew up in the same courses that he did. My dad, along with his dad, they were out playing, you know, how many days a week in the season that we could get, which is, you know, 6 months or so. And my older brother, Ryan, was influential that I went out there with them a lot and started playing, you know, when I was 5, 6, 7 years old. And I remember playing my first tournaments when I was about 7 years old too. And it was something that I fell in love with because it was an individual sport. You were responsible for how you played. You were responsible for how you prepared. And I just love the game, the challenge of it, the difficulty of it. And so I was from such a young age ready to do it and wanting to do it. And the team sports were fun, but there was something about golf and that individual aspect that I really appreciated from a young age. And so growing up in Blue Earth, you know, one of the best parts about it is the small town is that you played at a 9-hole course. The driving range was 250 yards long at the most. You picked up your own balls. So we just played out there all day. You know, mom would drop us off and give us a little bit of money, and we'd be out there all day long, going around and around, playing 36, 54 holes a day. And there's no better way to grow up to learn the game. And I think that's something I was very appreciative of, just learning how to play the game out on my own with my brother, with my dad, with my other friends out there. That was probably the most influential way I could have learned the game, was doing it that way rather than going to a driving range, getting lessons all the time. I remember my first lesson when I was 16. So before that, it was something my dad or my brother would tell me. And it was something simple, you know, grip, alignment, setup, something like that. And that we kept the game simple and we just played. You learn to get the ball in the hole. You learn to manufacture shots around the tree lines and up and over and down and below. And I think I'm very appreciative the longer I play that I grew up that way.
Yeah, it's funny now. I mean, small town kids like us, and I was a small towner, Manitoba, then Edmonton, and it was that sort of sense of security. Your family could drop you off. They knew where you were. You weren't going anywhere. You weren't getting in any trouble unless you found a key to a golf cart or something like that. That's a story for another time. But I mean, you get hated on a little bit being from these sort of small town hick areas. But like you said, I mean, that's just an experience that a lot of the kids nowadays will never get and never understand. And it never allows that imagination to kind of take shape.
No, not at all. Not at all. And I feel bad. I know that the kids nowadays that grew up at these country clubs, and now they're using launch monitors and they're using pressure plates and all that stuff. They have access to things that we couldn't have ever dreamed of. But I will say there is something to be said about learning to play the game on your own, and how much more trust in yourself that develops, and how much more instinctual you become. And that's something, like I said, I wouldn't trade that for anything, regardless of maybe what other kids have access to now and other players do. I still wouldn't have traded the way I grew up playing it for anything.
Yeah, I like that. That's a great way to sort of, great perspective. It really forces someone to dig it out of the dirt and learn it on their own without having to rely on, you know, instant feedback from a screen. So,
you know, in Parksy, you get a little past the age bias too, right? So you heard John say he played with his dad and his brother. Like, that's the staple foursome. Like, you, especially when you're a little bit better than most, which John or my brother was, and some of the other players, there was a hell of a run for about 10 years in this small little town that just produced state championships and kept going on and on. And there was a lot of community pride in that. And it was just slightly younger than I was, but you really truly had to understand generational families, right? Whether they were farming or they had a business in town or they were banking, but you were going to find a game. And so you had to learn as a 15, 16, 17 year old kid, you had to learn how to take your hat off and say thank you. You had to learn to talk to people. You had to know how to carry a conversation, and you could do something with a golf ball that they couldn't do, but yet you weren't old enough to essentially sign up for the military yet, right? So it was just a different way to understand. So when you talk about some of that small town stuff, and you can hear it in John's voice, there's just this kind of humbleness or this thought process that where you come from really does kind of intend, and it really does kind of make an impression on your DNA. But more importantly, you don't have a choice. It's not like you're going into AJGA where we're from. You might have a Minnesota, you know, a PGA Tour event that would have kids from other towns, but your dad's still taking you, and you've got to respect other parents, and they're always there, right? Like, my father never missed an event, and, you know, and I know John's was the same way, and they were the reasons we played. So you got up at 6:30 in the morning on Saturday, you're probably playing with your uncle and your father and maybe another brother, and then you're going to go in and you're going to have a hot dog and you're going to talk to another family, and all of the people are going to recognize you. There's no such thing as hiding. You're not ever going to be, you know, in the woods per se, but you do have this way where you can shake a hand, you can play, you learn conversations, you know what people do. And I think that more so because, let's be honest, I grew up on a golf course that didn't have a two-tiered green. I mean, yeah. Most holes don't have bunkers. I mean, they were lined by actual corn and soybean fields. Like, there weren't stakes. Like, it, and that's normal, right? That's not abnormal. That's normal to us. And so I really do think that generation of what would be my father's age now, which would be, you know, God forbid, in their mid-70s, which is hard to fathom. But it's amazing to me that we have this ability to have this talk tonight. We're going to get into it in a little bit, but knowing that he has that wherewithal, that where you're raised has a huge stamp on who you are. And, you know, and one of the things that I've learned over time is that never goes away. Like I don't get back as much, especially now that I'm year round and fall such a big season in Southern California, because it's our best weather. So I barely even get to go for football games anymore, which used to be two or three times a year. But that being said, I think that where we're going to go tonight has a lot to do. And I think you're going to hear a lot of those small town values, not from the cliche standpoint or to make yay versus nay, but more about, I think it's what's happening now. And you see the community pride and what comes back when things happen that necessarily aren't truly what you want.
John, you find this game, you're out playing golf, you're doing loops 999, you're going mental out there, hanging out with the buddies. You spend, you know, sun up to sundown. When did it start to click? When did you decide or start to feel like, hey, maybe I can do something with this? Maybe there's a competitive John in here that I want to pursue and challenge a bit.
You know, I would say the game always came relatively easy to me. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way. I mean it in the sense that I enjoyed it. I enjoyed practicing. I enjoyed getting better. And to Derek's point, which is perfect, is that when I was 10, 12, 14 years old, you'd go out on men's day and you were playing with guys who were 40, 50, 60 years old. So I think there was a level of maturity that I gained at a young age to, one, not only play and how they conducted themselves when they played, because there was a lot of good players. For being a small town and being a small club, there was a lot of guys who knew how to play golf and they knew how to be scratch golfers without ever having had a lesson and without having equipment that was right for them. And so I think playing with them sort of opened my eyes a little bit to just how you play the game as a grown man and as an adult, rather than playing it with a bunch of kids your age that are, you know, getting it tired and bored of it or whatever. I always knew how much I enjoyed the game. I would say I was probably about 13, 14 years old. I had a good finish in the state high school tournament in eighth grade, and that garnered some attention from some college coaches. And so I started noticing coaches out watching me at meets or out in tournaments in the summer. And I always knew that I watched golf on TV, and playing professional golf was something that I dreamed of doing, and it was a goal of mine. But I think once I realized I was getting closer to the college age and started realizing the attention that I was maybe getting from some of these coaches, that sort of opened my eye to saying, okay, it's becoming more realistic now. It's becoming more in the present rather than in the future. And it's something that came to the forefront of my mind that now each time I go out and play, there might be a little bit more with it now, rather than you just going out and playing as a kid with being carefree. It's a little bit more like, okay, now this is going somewhere with this. And each tournament that you play well in means a little bit more. And I think that's probably where it started. I was probably that 13, 14, 15 year old range.
Nice. That's, yeah, pressure, right? I mean, you start to feel different feels, and maybe mm-hmm. you sort of elevate and rise to the occasion and find some success. So now we're sort of in that entry level. We're dipping a toe in and we have some eyes on. How did you make a decision on the school you wanted to go to? And was it important to stay close to home and stay close to family?
It was important. I never envisioned myself going across the country. I didn't look real hard at other schools as well. I sent some letters out when I was young. My brother, fortunately, went through that process. He's four years older than me. So I watched him go through that college recruiting process a little bit, and where he wanted to go versus who wanted him, what he wanted to study, and what that led to ultimately for a decision for him. And so watching him go through that, it sort of gave me a little bit of experience without having any in that category. And so, you know, for me, it was a matter of, I was always a Gopher fan growing up, right? So we watched the Gophers play football, you watched them play basketball, you watched them play hockey. And I always knew that, you know, being a Gopher would be something that'd be pretty awesome. Living in your home state, playing for your home state, I don't know if it gets much better than that for a lot of people. Once I was about a sophomore or junior, I started getting more attention and talking to other coaches. And I kind of felt like it was going to be really hard for me to go to a program like Wisconsin or Illinois when I was a Gopher fan my whole life. And it was no disrespect to those coaches or to those programs, because Illinois was on the way up and Wisconsin had a great program and a great coach. But to me, once I knew Minnesota was interested and they were willing to offer me a scholarship, it was hard to say no to that in the years of rooting for them and saying I can stay home and represent my home state. I think that was something that meant a lot to me and was able to fulfill a dream, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you can't turn down an opportunity to go to war with your brothers. You know what I mean? Like something mm-hmm. you've invested in. There's the buy-in. There's the appreciation. You're owning it already. So it's, yeah, I can't imagine wanting to go somewhere else. So we're in college. We're finding some success. Maybe talk us through some of the collegiate years and some of the tournaments, some of the pressure, maybe some of the different feels you started experiencing and how your game evolved.
Yeah. So like I mentioned earlier, I had no real experience with coaching or getting lessons, any technical advice to speak of. I kind of figured it out myself. And so my senior year in high school, I went post-secondary to Minnesota State. So I was able to take all my classes up there to get college credit for when I went to Minnesota. And so I was able to start working with my coach, Andrew Tank, at the time at Minnesota. We could start working on my swing through various NCAA-approved camps and things like that. So I was able to start to work with them my senior year, which was pretty important looking back, because although I didn't play very well at the time and it was all new to me, it helped with that development process really quickly. I was able to understand where they were coming from, how they saw the swing, how they saw my swing, what direction we were planning to go with it. So I started doing that my senior year. And then by the time I was a freshman, I was a little deep into the technical side of things. And that was new to me. And I'll be honest, it wasn't very fun. It was so different from how I grew up playing. And I don't regret it, but I do look back and wish I would have had a little bit more conviction in how I had played. I think I was always one that had a little bit too much of that Midwest humility, and that I didn't stand up for myself in the sense of, hey, I know what's best for me. I was so willing to learn and wanted to learn and wanted to get better that I was willing to do anything it took. Part of that is, you know, you can run yourself down some tough roads and you don't really get out of them for a few years once you look back to sort of see, okay, now I know what they meant. Now I know what they wanted, what was best for me. But at the time, I should have spoken up for myself a little bit. So it took me a couple of years to get my feet and get them back under me a little bit and sort of understand how I used to swing, how I'm swinging now, and go from it in that perspective. But by the time I figured that out, I was more mature and older and ready to be able to compete and play, and finally started to believe in myself that I didn't put anyone on a pedestal anymore. Maybe my own teammates included, but especially guys we played against and names that you recognize that were all Americans and things like that. It was now, I was like, okay, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to play. It was just maybe a couple years later than I wanted it to be. But you know, it ultimately led to a Big Ten title for our team. I didn't win individually, but I finished third and contributed to the team. And that was still one of the greatest memories I ever have on a golf course, was winning that tournament, especially because Illinois has won, I don't know, 12 of 13 or 13 of 14 or something like that. And we're the only team to get in the middle of that run that they've had, as they've been producing tour players too. So that was still the greatest memory. And I have some of my closest and best friends were my teammates in Minnesota. And so those were five of the most important years of my life and best years of my life, whether the golf was good or not. It was all worth it. And I learned a ton from my coaches and my teammates while I was there.
It's a little trial by fire, right? I mean, It's funny, a lot of PGA Tour players, they get out on tour, Korn Ferry Tour or PGA Tour, and then they start messing with everything that got them there.
Yes.
And then, you know, it takes them a year or two to either come back home and find it again, or that's the end of the career because they've just played themselves right out of it. So yep. Interesting that you had an opportunity to sort of endure that early on where it didn't really mess with you, you know, as you're starting to progress to a mini tour play and then, you know, onwards and upwards. So.
And you know, Parksy too, that's also the era of the swing coach, right? So that's when it really all started. So you would always, growing up, and a lot of our listeners aren't going to remember before Tiger was on the PGA Tour, but you know, it was a big deal who was going to get him, right? And so Butch was the guy. But that's, you know, it used to be Flick, and Ledbetter and just a couple of these guys, Jimmy Ballard, that would do their thing. And it wasn't what it was now. And, you know, one of the hardest things that John can attest to is that when you are in the tundra, you've got to have different opportunities to make yourself better, right? You've got to go with different thought processes. You might end up on, you know, swing thoughts. You're going to try and be aggressive on certain things. You got to show that you're technologically savvy. I mean, you've got to prove, as golf was starting to mature fast, you know, so you're talking not very long before Tiger breaks out at Augusta, and you're talking into the early 2000s from what he'll kind of talk on here in a little bit. But, you know, that was also the era where golf was trying to figure itself out. You know, swing plane wasn't all you talked about. Now fitness was being worked in, and what are we doing? And length was becoming a huge part of it. And the metals were changing from wood to metals, right? And the golf ball changing from Bellotta to, you know, what was it one time, you know, turning into the professional, which is now the Pro V1. But golf was in that time, right where John was going to end up being, you know, right before his competitive career is getting off. He's in that time now where golf was taking this whole huge change through the world. And I think that, like he said, Mike Small at Illinois and some of these coaches got it early, but it wasn't easy at that point because everything was changing from just true swing plane and feel to technicalities and getting faster, bigger, faster, stronger. And all of that took hold. And I mean, now we look at it today and it's like, you know, Tiger was an animal when he was running before and after his workouts. Now what these guys do before they go play in workout clothes would, I mean, I'm not sure half of the PGA Tour in the late 80s and the 90s could have even done what they did and then go out and play. And I'm just being honest, right? You can't have a dart and a hot dog. It just didn't work that way. And JT and those guys, he was right at the beginning when golf took that huge change for us professionally.
So what were the next steps, John? I mean, you weren't sitting in the bar drinking before rounds like these guys on the PGA Tour were, and this whole evolution of technology and swing thought, swing path, the mental side of the game was obviously starting to be developed and something that people paid attention to. Let's talk about your transition from collegiate play to experiencing mini tour golf and really getting yourself out there and grinding.
Yeah. One of the biggest things I did was my junior year, I started working with a sports psychologist. And to Derek's point, which is perfect, I went from not having a lesson to, you know, halfway through my collegiate career is when we bought a TrackMan at Minnesota. And that was the first time that we were starting to use that. And none of us even really knew what the numbers meant. We didn't know what we were supposed to do with them. So I think we switched equipment companies 3 or 4 times in college. I had 3 different head coaches while I was at Minnesota with some turnover there. And so there was a lot of information. There was a lot of different opinions that were kind of getting tossed around. And so deciding what was best for you when you're a 21, 22-year-old kid is not easy. And then doing it as a collegiate athlete with advancements in technology and information and new coaching staffs, that made it definitely challenging. And so I kind of took it upon myself my junior year to say, okay, I know physically I'm a good enough athlete. I've got a good enough swing. There's always things you're going to improve, but I knew I needed to get better mentally because I knew that that's where I was holding myself back a little bit. There was kind of some self-preservation, I suppose, at that point that you got to let yourself go and you've got to be willing to free it up and play to the level you know you're capable of playing. And so I started working with Dr. Justin Anderson in Minneapolis. And that was huge for me. That was a massive turning point for my career because being able to have somebody to talk to, go over things after tournaments, before tournaments, I could shoot them a text during a tournament, things like that, that was huge. And that last year and a half at school I felt like a completely different player because of that. And I was able to declutter a lot of things that had been in my head for 3.5 years and get back to the things that I did well, along with some of the things that I learned. And I know that I give a lot of credit to him for the start of my professional career as well. And I still talk to him to this day. But as I turned pro, I was coming off of a good senior year. So that was, there was some confidence there, but I didn't really know what to expect. I didn't have a lot of specific goals. It was, to me, I was in that process of, let's just see how good we can get. If that leads us to the PGA Tour, if that leads us to winning majors, if that leads us to making cuts in mini tour events, let's just see what we can do. And for better or for worse, I think that was a good thing for me. I know other people probably don't operate that same way and they want to win a US Open in 3 years. And don't get me wrong, that was still a goal. But I think I was at a point where I was just so into the process of just become the best player that I could, that it fit right into that time period in my game and in my life. And so turning pro is a quick adjustment, although I played well right away. I won a couple tournaments in the first 6 months, earned status down in Latin America. And so I was able to sort of get my feet wet in professional golf, come out of it with a little bit of confidence, but also still know, okay, I got a long ways to go. There's a lot of things I can get better at. But I had a good support staff there with Dr. Anderson and my friends that were around me that were turning pro at the same time. We were all kind of going through it together, which was nice to be able to live together and to bounce ideas off each other, practice with each other. That was important too. I'd say as I transitioned to professional golf, like most would say, the biggest difference is that there's a big difference mentally when you're playing for money. When you're putting your own money on the line and you're playing for money, and that's how you pay rent, that's how you pay for your next tournament, that's how you save up money to do anything you want to do as a 23, 24 year old. That was a huge transition. And I think a lot of pros would probably agree with me on that. But the best players find a way to play their best golf no matter what's at stake and no matter what's on the line. And that's not to deny what's on the line and act like it isn't there, but it's just to be able to get into your own process internally and know, okay, I can still do this just like I did last year in college, just like I did earlier this year, you know, in the summer in some tournament with my buddies, and just like I can do at Q school in the fall. I can play my best when I need to, without putting that added pressure on it. Cause we know that there's just more when you turn professional. That's just kind of the way it is. It really is.
Is it that easy to frame confidence and believe in yourself, or was it nice to have that support system there that kind of contributed to, you know, any doubts that crept in? You always had somebody to talk to, or were you just thinking, hey, I'm playing well, I know I have game, I'm just going to ride this. And you said something earlier, free it up. Mm-hmm. So how did you find a way to free it up when it really mattered?
To be honest with you, I'm not really sure I've ever been able to free it up. I think that's something that I'm still in the process of figuring out. But going through it with my other buddies and my close friends was big, because we could talk to each other after a round. And we knew exactly what each other were going through. And so I could learn a lot from my friends talking to them about their rounds or me talking about my round. I did have to, you know, internalize a lot of things myself, though, and go back to the stuff that I was working on with Dr. Anderson and the things that had made me a better player. I was able to carry that over to the professional game fairly quickly that first year or so. But then you get to that point, and all of a sudden you hit that road bump, and just like that, you know, now you miss a couple cuts in a row, and you know you've got a few more coming up, and Q school's around the corner, and so that pressure of being a true professional starts to add up. And I relied on my friends quite a bit, and I'm sure they relied on me as well. And to your point, learning to free it up is really difficult. And I think there's probably a lot of good players who have never been able to free it up. And some people can play really well doing that, playing like they're very, very controlled and not taking many risks and kind of almost playing tight. I don't know that I'm one of those guys, but it's something we're always trying to figure out. And I think you're trying to figure it out, whether you play once a week, whether you play, you know, as a top level amateur or as a professional. I think you're always trying to find what works for you and how you tick. And yeah, I'm definitely still in the process of figuring that out right now. I know that.
At any point were you taking the classified section and throw it in the golf bag during the tournaments, just in case it didn't go your way, you had something to fall back on? Or was golf always the pursuit, was going to be the be all end all?
Golf was kind of always plan A and plan B. I look back and I think there's times where I wish I would have maybe had a little bit more focus in college. I got good enough grades and all that, but maybe paid a little more attention to what I was interested in. But at the end of the day, I don't regret it. I also know golf, you know, was always number one, and I wanted it to be that way. And I always knew that I would use what I've learned in golf to make myself the best at what I could be, even if I did something else. And, you know, my life, if it isn't as a professional golfer in the PGA Tour, I'd be very happy if it was something within golf and within the sport that I grew up loving and has meant so much to me and so much to my family, that I would be more than happy to do something in the game.
You know, golf is kind of like tree sap. Once you get it on you, you just can't get rid of it. No matter what solvent you use or how much you just hate the smell or the taste, it's just, it's always there. But it's a great equalizer. And it's this collective melting pot of people and opportunities and business and arenas and landscapes. It's so weird that it just, there's so many crossroads in golf. So, I mean, I love the fact that that was plan A and plan B. And it sounds like you had a great upbringing and there was always going to be something for you, regardless of golf.
Well, in that too, Parksy, it's our version of nobody walks away. They just don't. I mean, nobody walks away, right? They all say they're going to, and yet they all come back, right?
Tomorrow.
They all get upset. They all come back. And I think that the metaphor to life is real. And what I want to get into, JT, is, okay, let's talk about where we are now. Let's talk about, you know, we found somebody in life. You're happy. You've got that beautiful ring on your left finger. Let's get into why we really are in this conversation, because, you know, I would talk to you all day if I could, but we need to now kind of get to the deep and into the deep side of the pool and talk about where we are in life and what we can do to help and how we're going to be supportive and whatever we can do for you.
Yeah. So it was kind of started in last May. I had a fairly routine check at the dermatologist, and my wife actually encouraged me to go in because I hadn't been in for a couple of years with COVID. And I had two small moles removed, one on my knee and one on my shoulder blade, and got a call about 3 weeks later that they were both melanoma. So we are going to go in and go into to Minneapolis and get a little bit more removed. So I had a plastic surgeon that I was referred to, and he removed a little bit more from both my knee and my shoulder blade, and then he took lymph nodes out, which I thought at the time was fairly aggressive. I didn't, you know, it seemed like they were superficial from what I was being told, but in hindsight, obviously it was the right move. And so they did find a little bit of spread of the melanoma to one of the lymph nodes. So that was in June. And so I had a little bit removed, missed about 5-6 weeks, and went back to playing golf, went back to things, life is normal, right? And things are usual. And so about 4 or 5 weeks after that, I noticed a little a bump on my right armpit shoulder area. And I thought at the time it was scar tissue. There was no pain. There was no restriction. Thought it could have been something from surgery. And my oncologist definitely didn't like that. So we had that biopsied, which came back as melanoma in that lymph node in November. So at that point, I switched everything over to Mayo, to the Mayo Clinic, and I started immunotherapy as we found a little bit of spread both in that lymph node and then into a rib on my right side. So I started immunotherapy in November and had my third treatment in January, and noticed a couple of days after that I wasn't feeling very well. A couple of side effects were some joint pain and stiffness and things like that, and I was definitely feeling that. So I didn't think much of it, but I knew it was just part of the side effects. And we had that for about 2-3 weeks, and we were meant to go up a week later for my fourth immunotherapy treatment. And I wasn't feeling well one night, and to be completely candid, I went to the restroom and there was blood in the urine. And so we both knew that that wasn't good. So my wife took me into the ER the next morning, and we were in touch with my oncologist, and we ordered the ER doctor ordered a CT scan and to rule out what it could be. And they found some spread that was in my hip and in my femur on my left side, as well as some in my liver. So immediately went to Rochester, had a full set of scans again, and found quite a bit of spread, a lot of small spots, but kind of all over, a lot of bone disease. So they found a couple of larger spots in my left femur. And so my oncologist and the orthopedic surgeon basically said right away, we need to operate. We need to put a rod into that femur so that it doesn't fracture. Because if it were to fracture, we're going to have a lot more problems down the road, both from a treatment perspective, but also just from a pure fracturing perspective and what that's going to do for healing and pain moving forward. So it was about 7 weeks ago now, this week, that at the Mayo Clinic, I went in for surgery. They put a rod into my left femur, And while they were in there, then they x-rayed it and decided that the right femur should have a rod in it as well, because they figured, one, there's enough disease in that right femur and in the bone, but also I would favor that right leg so much in recovery that that could actually lead to problems too. And so within a 3-day window, they put a rod into each femur, so both legs, and that was the start of basically a whole new chapter for me. Fortunately, the orthopedic surgeon was really optimistic and the surgeries went well, and he said I wouldn't have any future restrictions, which I thought was pretty crazy, because without knowing much, I'm thinking, if you're going to put rods into bones, I'm thinking, man, that sounds like I'm going to be in the hospital for a while. That sounds like I'm going to be in a cast. And I was walking the next day after both surgeries, went home a couple of days later. And, you know, here we are 7 weeks later. And now I haven't used a walker for a few weeks. I'm going up and down stairs, able to dress myself, able to do all that stuff. So we've come a long ways in 7 weeks. And I started new medication 6 weeks ago. And so we're in the middle of that right now. And honestly, I feel really good. I probably feel better now. I definitely feel better now than I did before the surgery. And now that I look back, I realize how much pain I was in. And I didn't know it. I just sort of chalked it up to side effects of the treatment. Had no idea that this was going on. But here we are. And, you know, we haven't obviously been able to play any golf or do anything like that. But I'm just happy to be able to take it one day at a time, be able to get some daily function back, and be able to do the things, you know, that you take for granted you do every single day, that you now realize it's hard to bend over, it's hard to take, you know, lift your leg up to walk up and down steps. So here we are, and we're moving forward, and we'll be getting scans in another couple weeks in mid-April to see how the medication's working and see what kind of comes after that.
So, have you checked with the USGA or the PGA Tour to make sure that the rods are compliant, just in case there's any issues moving forward if the career picks up again?
I haven't. They've got enough problems, I think, with the blowback from changing the golf ball in a few years, that I think the least of their concerns are whether the rods are conforming or not.
The bionic man. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. No issues.
Well, so let's talk a little bit. Obviously, we mentioned earlier about your wedding ring. You've been lucky enough to marry Allie, and her family, along with your family, have been a big help. So let's talk about the next 6 months. What's ahead for you? How you kind of explain the process of getting back to being John Trasmar, and what the things go along with that. Let's dive a little bit into your personal life, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about Allie and everything. Let's kind of let our listeners know what's going to come up of all of this.
Yes, I mean, we have scans, like I said, in a couple of weeks, and that'll kind of determine what I can do in the near future right after that. Right before surgery, based on what the scans looked like, they were concerned about fractures in multiple places, you know, whether it was a rib, a hip, you know, spine, things like that. So hopefully, if the medications are working as well as what I feel, and I think they are, they'll come back good in April, and we can move forward with getting back to doing more activity, getting it back into the gym, getting back into playing golf, things like that. As far as the next 6 months, my hope is to beat this thing within the next 6 months. I don't know if that's realistic or not. And I honestly don't really care, because I think that's just a goal to set out and say, you know what, let's go do it. But we are taking it one day at a time, because the nice part is this process with the legs has forced me to be very present, and it's forced me to be here and take it one day at a time. And I'm very fortunate that my wife, who's an absolute rock star, has been able to be with me this whole time. She's been taking a leave of absence from work. She's been there every step of the way. And I couldn't be more thankful for that and for her, because I know how much this weighs on her and how much this weighs on her family and my family. And so to have the support of all of them has been incredible. And quite frankly, I think I'd be in a very different position mentally if it wasn't for them. I know I would be. So there's a lot of good reasons to fight. And my hope is that I can deliver the best news possible, not only in a couple of weeks, but in a couple months, and get this thing taken care of over the course of the next, or the remainder of the year.
Well, I can speak on behalf of Allie, and I promise you, as much as what you just said is true, it's also her unbelievable honor to be next to you doing the same thing. So as someone who's been through this fight, I know immensely exactly what you guys are feeling, and I know how hard it is to be day to day. That's never an easy thing. And one of the things I was so proud when I contacted you to see if you wanted to do this was, I just know that not only is your humility going to shine through, but I know you're not afraid of having tough conversations. I know who you are, and I know what you've come through. I've been lucky enough to travel and play golf with you. We played in fun stuff and John Ashworth stuff. And obviously you're part of my hometown community and something I'd do anything for. But I think the biggest thing you want to know is obviously that dermatology checks are real. Just so you know, I've had one within the last 2 weeks because of you. I'm a huge believer in checkups, and we've got a lot of foundations helping people get those. But I think that the thought process for you is 100% on point. I'm insanely proud to hear that you're doing well. I love your attitude and your motivation. But let's talk a little bit going forward about what you would tell others in your position. Let's talk about some checkups, maybe some stuff they can do as far as sunscreen, things that you've been talked about. You know, I've always been told by my dermatologists, because I'm in golf, I've always been religious about going. But, you know, the bottom lip is usually the most unprotected place on a male body as far as sun protection. So if you don't mind, can you just give some tips and some things to do and some things hopefully our listeners will follow and kind of take inspiration from what it is you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was okay at it, I would say. I've gotten better as I've gotten older about wearing sunscreen and about reapplying. I think that's one thing, too, that I was not good about. I'd put sunscreen on in the morning and I'd be out there for 10 hours and you know, within a couple hours, it's like, you need to put more on. And so I've gotten better about that as the years have gone along, but it's not asking a lot, as much as we're in the sun as golfers and even non-golfers, to go to the dermatologist and just take a quick check. And they know what they're looking at. They know what they're looking for. And it can put your mind at ease, especially to be able to just free it up to know I can go right back out and do my job, or I can be with my friends and my family in the sun. And so I'm trying to hopefully be a good thing for people to be able to look at and say, okay, it doesn't take much for this whole process to start. And so we want to stay in front of it, make sure that we're going to the doctor once a year for a checkup, just to kind of have them take a look and give you the clean bill of health that you want, that you're looking for, and you hope you're getting. Wearing more sunscreen, and like I said, reapplying, I was not good at that, but the ears and the bottom lip, like you said, Derek, and the nose, the things that are always out in the sun that don't get covered up. You know, we wear pants a lot when we play, so it's not like your legs are necessarily getting it. But like I, in my case, I had a mole that was on my knee that I saw, but isn't something you're always going to give attention to when you're looking in the mirror. So I know that that's a big thing, and reminding your friends and your family that if they don't go to the dermatologist or if they don't put sunscreen on, there's a lot of good brands of sunscreens out there now that are clean and good for you. And it just takes, you know, a quick 60 seconds, if that, to put some sunscreen on and giving yourself and your loved ones the peace of mind to know I'm doing what I can to make sure, you know, I'm at my healthiest and my safest. And we go to the gym, we might diet and watch what we eat. And this is just another thing we can do to try to be as healthy and live as long as we can.
Yeah, that's obviously it's a great reminder, and a lot of people avoid those checkups, but it's so important. I mean, it can be an inconvenience, but at the same capacity, I mean, you know, later in life when you have grandkids or you want to spend those golden years with friends, family, a loved one, you know, that's important to think back about, hey man, it's only 10 seconds, 60 seconds, or half an hour to go see a doctor. So it's well worth that sort of, I don't know, stretch of time or sort of inconvenience at that capacity. So
no question.
Yeah. Well, so we're going to do some rehab. We're hoping for some, you know, some positive checkups.
Yep.
Is indoor putting something we're thinking about right now? Or are we thinking about going around chipping a little bit, or is that sort of off the books for the time being?
I'm definitely thinking about it. I know that. I don't know if my doctors are thinking about that yet. They're getting close to it. Like I said, I think their biggest concern was fracturing in certain places and that causing more problems. So I can take my stance. I'm doing some slow motion air swings. Don't tell them, but you know, just to work on a couple things that I had in my mind that I've worked on over the last 6 months mentally to say, okay, when I get back out there, this is what I'm going to do. That's what I'm going to do. But yeah, we're getting close, and I'm anticipating hopefully a little bit more flexibility in what we can do. And if that means take small steps and start with putting and chipping, we can do that. No problem at all. I'll be patient with this and do what they tell me, but I'm definitely starting to get the itch and getting ready to get back out there and get back to playing.
Yeah. I mean, the weather's warming up out there and the snow's starting to melt. So you gotta be getting cabin fever here.
That's right. Feel bad. That's right.
Well, JT, it means the world that you took the time to come on. Obviously, we come from a very small fraternity in the middle of nowhere that is flyover country. And a lot of the times I forget, and I'm the first to admit, I forget how much I love where I was raised, the principles and what I had. And obviously, my father passed away early, and we're coming up on, I've almost been alive or alive without him longer than I was with him. And so you start to think about all of the things you and I and Dusty and the good old family and everything that we've gone through in that little small town, you know, and it's hard to look back sometimes and think that it's almost, well, it is over 30 years for me, but you think about where we were raised and how we did it and the community side of it. And it's not something that you ever want to talk about in this situation. You know, it's not where we want to lead people to, but let's talk a little bit about the GoFundMe. It's important to me to get it out. Like I said, as somebody who's been there, I know that you have one. We do have an unbelievable listener base. And the reason we do have that is because people not only love the sport, but they're very interested in the people that we bring on. And they've shown their loyalty to us over years. And I think this is one of those come to Jesus moments where people need to know that, hey, life is bigger than what you are. It's more about what you give. So let's go over your socials and let's talk a little bit about that GoFundMe before we end, because I don't beg for much. I'm not that kind of guy. You know me, I'll give to anybody. And if it's somebody the way we grew up, I don't even blink. Just tell me what you need. But more importantly for us, I think this is one of those times in the world where good people need good things. So let's relive those numbers and let's talk a little bit about your socials and those abilities to talk about the GoFundMe.
Yeah, my friends, a couple of my college teammates, set that up when I was in the hospital right before surgery. And they kind of asked how I was doing and if there was anything I needed. And I said, you know, I'm going to be fine and we'll get through this and there won't be a problem. And they kind of took it upon themselves to set the GoFundMe up. And it's been incredibly humbling and inspiring to see how many people have donated and just how much people care and how much they support. And it's been something that it's made me really want to give back to those and give to others. But it's been incredible. And I never would have expected anything like this. My wife didn't expect anything like this. And it's been something that has changed my life and the way I think of people and the way I think of others and what I want to do for them when I get the opportunity to do that. And it's something that I'll cherish for forever. And it's been a pretty incredible experience, to be honest with you. As much as this isn't what we've wanted or how we've wanted to go about it, it's opened my eyes even more that people are just really good and they have huge hearts and they care so much.
Okay, well, for those that don't know, it's J-O-N and it's T-R-A-S-A-M-A-R, John Trasmar. His wife's name is Allie, and there is a GoFundMe set up. So I want to make sure you know that on the way out, the Four Jack is donating $1,000 to the GoFundMe. I'm going to do that in the name of the Four Jack. It's the least I can do for you. And I will also work on our end to continue to make sure that people understand just how amazing of a human you are. You've been incredibly benevolent tonight. You've shared everything behind the curtain. You had no reason to other than the fact that we're just friends. You didn't have to do this, but I just can't get enough of people who want to help others. And I think it's really important for the rest of the world to take notice that when good people have some time of hardship that they've got to understand it. So congratulations to you and to Allie and her family and the Trasmar family and all of the people in Winnebago and Blue Earth and Elmore and everybody that I've looked down. And one of my favorite things to do is, as crazy as it is to say that, is to go through those lists and just say, you know what, I know just about every name on that list. And that's the humbling part of why I never forget where I come from. So congratulations to you on the GoFundMe, but more importantly to your attitude and the spirit that's going to beat this, because if I had to put somebody up against this, excuse my language, but this fucking disease, it would be you, because that smile and that sense of discipline is unlike anything else. So we're here for you, whatever you need. I can't wait. You will be my absolute favorite guest, selfishly, when you come back on and get to tell us the great news, okay?
I appreciate that. Thank you guys for having me. It means a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like Derek said, anything we can do at all, we're going to do our best to promote the crap out of this for you. So appreciate your time tonight. You've been very gracious with some of your stories and giving us a little peek behind the curtain of something very personal. But I mean, it does resonate with our audience and a lot of people can relate to it. So continued success, wishing a clear bill of health, obviously, and can't wait to get you on the golf course down the road. But if there's rods in the legs, I think I need some sugar, maybe, Derek.
We'll see about that. I don't know yet. We'll have to see.
Parksy never stops begging for candy, JT.
Hey, man, I've heard things about this guy. He can play, so I'm a little fearful. So it's all right. Good, though.
Get some sleep, John. Thank you for your time, and we'll be in touch soon. I'll text you later, okay?
Sounds good. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care. All the best.
All right, Four Jack fam, unless you've been living under a rock, you know we're heading into Masters Week. And our new partnership with Swing Tweaks has a special offer for you. That's right, this week and this week only, they're giving away one Swing Tweak and 20% off on sign up using code MASTERS. If you want to get better at golf and you don't want to spend hundreds and thousands of dollars, then download the Swing Tweaks app. It's a more affordable convenient way to get a lesson from a certified PGA professional. Yes, someone that has actually spent time learning the mechanics of the golf swing and knows what they're talking about. All you need to do is jump on the app, record your swing from a couple different angles. The app will help you through this. Tell us what you're struggling with and hit send. Honestly, it's that simple. Within 6 hours, you'll receive a full video lesson from a professional. They'll analyze your swing, view the potential pain points, and talk you through the solutions, providing professional advice and the correct drills to work through during your practice. If you want to take the guesswork out of game improvement, Swing Tweaks is that solution. Again, for this week and this week only, use code MASTERS at sign up. Absolutely no strings attached. What have you got to lose, honestly, but a few strokes? Have a great Masters week.